So today everything is about the semantic analysis. So in principle, you could now ask, what is there more than just the parse tree or syntax tree of a language? Isn't that already everything that we can get out of the input? Well, you can always try with plain parsers and see what you can actually find in the input. And it turns out that not all the programs that keep to the grammar of a certain language actually make sense, although they perfectly fit into the grammar of such a language. Well, what be typical cases of that? Well, actual complete compilers do try to check for more than just syntactical correctness and try to get a grasp of the sense of what someone is doing, in the sense that they recognize erroneous specification of input. And yeah, what does that mean for each language? Well, for example, there's grammatically you can specify a correct program, and for example, in something like C or Java or something, you have these special tokens that you call the identifiers, which are just, well, freely chosen notations for your program variables, and you can insert any of the names that you have chosen in any place where you have an identifier in your parse tree. However, that in languages which have this concept of declaring a variable name and then having a scope for a certain variable name, you're not exactly free to choose all the places where to insert a certain variable name into a terminal for identifier, but you're kind of context dependent. Namely, you're dependent on the scope of the variable, which is a syntactic property, different from just the plain existence of an identifier, and maybe the sequence, for example, in which statements appear, because you might have something like a declaration statement, and that's only just the start for certain things. Also, there's also other things like the type correct use of a variable. Well, although a variable might be declared for a certain scope and used in there, it's still not valid to be inserted in every slot where you can actually put an identifier within its scope. There are still requirements on the type, and type is something which is not a purely syntactical property, but instead is something that's determined by something, by the declaration site of your identifier or variable name. So the type correct usage of variables is also something which is not context free, but it's something which is dependent on the concept of program flow somehow. So these are typical examples for things that are not captured with just syntactic tools, but instead you need something more than just plain scanner parsers. Nevertheless, you see in today's languages that it is possible to do so. So there must be some place within this whole stack of tools where these type of properties are actually verified or inferred. So that is the phase of semantic analysis. Other uses might be, for example, that you want to somehow optimize the code of your program. You might somehow want to switch around certain statements. You want to transform complicated statements into others, or even generate code, which can also be considered to be a certain semantic analysis, all the while there's still a synthetic phase also connected to that. Also, you might want to warn about possible or possibly incorrect programs. There's situations where you can find for certain combinations of properties where it's highly probable that the programmer didn't actually want to specify something like that. That would also be something that you would do during the semantic analysis. So, all in all, what those things have together is that most of them work by taking the syntax tree as an input and computing attributes for the nodes within the syntax tree that would attach certain semantic information to that particular occurrence of a non-terminal or terminal. And that would be the context-dependent attribute of a certain of such a node. And the means to achieve something like that, at least the one that's kind of a generic one, is to resort to something like attribute grammars. So for attribute grammars, you understand the particular subtrees of a trees as being a kind of a generator for certain computations, and in each of these subtrees, these computations are carried out just depending on, for once, the type of the subtree, in the sense that the type of the subtree would be determined by determined by the root of that particular subtree, and the results that have been produced for particular nodes that take part in that subtree during other local computations in adjacent subtrees. And the way that these attributes are then taken and used for computing values for other attributes occur in these so-called local computations. You've seen examples for things like that already in the very beginning of the lecture when we talked about the regular expressions. Remember, we had regular expressions represented as the parse trees of or syntax trees of regular expressions, and we introduced certain properties or attributes for all the nodes within these trees, and then performed computations on these attributes. So, if we don't restrain ourselves to just the one specialized version of this principle, which was this Berry-Sethi construction, but if we look at it more from a more distant view, we can think of this concept as an attribute grammar, which is just consists in context-free grammar, which is extended by a certain set of attributes for the symbols of the grammar, which are the non-terminals and terminals, and a set of attribute equations, which are local for each of these kinds of subtrees. We've seen such equations also for the Berry-Sethi construction, depending on whether the operators were alternation or concatenation or Kleene star or whatever there was. And if you think back, you also remember that there was something about the order in which you would have to compute these attributes, also depending on the, in that case, particularly just the attributes. So there were these notions of computing from bottom up or from top down, and also a few relations between the particular attributes. So particularly there was the sequence in which the syntax tree had to be run through in order to compute something. So, for example, the empty attribute. Well, when you remember, there was this animation where we started with just the ones where we could tell immediately what the attribute's value should be, and from that started to perform these local computations. So, for example, in here we could do a local computation, in there also, and computed these, yielding new values for attributes of the intermediate nodes. And from there on, we would continue with a local computation like this one here, and, well, of course, the other one that I missed, and then there's the last one that we're going to do. So that was already an example for an attribute grammar or an attribute system. And, yeah, in that case, there was an evaluation order. We had to go through that from a bottom to top, or bottom up in our case. So for our implementation of such a system, what we did was we chose a certain strategy to evaluate particularly that attribute. First of all, we would associate an attribute, in this case empty, to every node of the syntax tree. Then we would compute the attributes in depth-first post-order traversal. So this depth-first post-order traversal was kind of our strategy in our case in order to evaluate the system such that we would get our desired value, which was in that case computing for each of the nodes that particular attribute. And in particular, the depth-first post-order traversal would mean that at a leaf we computed the value independently of any other attributes. We could just tell it from, in that case we would consider the value of the terminals in our syntax tree as a kind of a read-only attribute that was given to us by just the parsing run. And so that was just a local attribute that contributed in whether the attribute would evaluate to empty or not. And for an inner node, the computation of the attribute empty would then just depend on the children. So in that way, we could consider the empty attribute as being something that was synthesized out of the input. So we would call it a synthetic attribute. So in general, we can disambiguate between these two cases of computation strategies for attributes. So there's the synthetic strategy, which would mean that a value would be always propagated upwards through the tree, and then there's also the other way, which is the inherited, which would propagate information downwards into the tree from root to leaf. We've talked about the idea of setting up local computation rules for attributes, and that is something that looked like this, at least while we talked about the empty attribute of regular expressions. So that's something you already knew. And in here we have the dependency on the type of the subtree somehow hidden in these parameters over here. There's the operator node is over here or in there or in there, and we have specified the evaluation of the attribute of an inner node in dependence of its children, for example. We've done for the alternation operator, we have specified that for the complete sub-expression R1 or R2, we would be depending on the attribute of its left child and its right child. However, that was a very specialized notation, and it's kind of messy, as we always have to somehow insert the complete expression that we are actually talking about right now into as parameter for this function. Instead, we would go to a more general way of specifying attribute equalities or systems of these equalities by abstracting away from the concrete expressions on which we want to perform the computations, but instead we would give these equalities in an abstract notation by moving to just the name of the attribute. In this case, it's attribute k, and indices for there. So with the index 0, we would address the root node, and with the indices 1 to arbitrary number, depending on how many children there actually are for a specific subtree, we would then address the ith child of the thing. So for example, when we transform our empty formalism into the new way of expressing it, we would for each of the productions, we would then notate it that way. So instead of having the expression inside the brackets each time, we would just have a shorthand by specifying with 0 that we actually mean the parent. So at first, this seems like nothing. There's nothing better to that. It's just a shorthand. And later on, we will get much larger systems of equalities. So we don't want to specify the actual right-hand side of such a production anymore within the systems of equalities. So we want to move away from that and just specify for each production, which we would mention over here, we would want to specify all the equalities that are possible to that are relevant for that subtree at once, and for that we would introduce this scheme of addressing the nodes via the attribute name and the index. Okay, so this is kind of the same as we had before, but just with the new way of notating, the new notation. Yeah, and all in all, what is needed for an automatic way of evaluating such attribute systems is that out of the local set of attribute equations, we would want to have a global algorithm that somehow connects all these local computations to each other and determines the final evaluations for each of these attributes. For that, we somehow need a sequence in which the nodes of the trees are visited. So for the simple cases, that's maybe just a plain run from bottom to top or top to bottom. But it might be more complicated as soon as you have more complicated equalities that are cross-referencing each other. You might not be so lucky to just have a plain bottom-up or top-down run through the whole thing. And also, you need locally a strategy for within each node to determine how the equations within the node itself need to be evaluated. So these are the two choices that you need to do. So on all these are the things that contribute to the evaluation strategy, and that is the key thing to come up with for a new system of attributes. And yeah, this has to be supporting the dependencies that you specify between the attributes. So for talking about these computations of strategies, we introduce the notion of the local dependency graph, which is, yeah, which you can see over here for the example of the empty attribute in the context of the alternation operator. So the empty attribute, for that you would have to take the evaluations of the attribute for the children and mangle them in order to obtain the new value for the empty attribute of the parent. So somehow the parent's attribute was depending on as well the child one's attribute as also child two's attribute. So we would annotate that in the dependency graph of the whole thing by creating an edge between the node for the empty attribute of the left child and the empty attribute for the parent. Same we would do for the empty attribute of the right child and also the parent's node. And yeah, that would be the local dependencies of that particular subtree category and the attribute empty. The second way of denoting that is just the more mathematical notation of a set of dependencies by just keeping book of all the edges in the form of tuples with the origin of an edge as the left component of the tuple and the target of the edge as the second component of the attribute, and then just listing all the particular edges of the graph one after each other within the set for TP. So of course, the more graphical and maybe more appealing version of talking about the of dealing with computations with the dependency graph is, of course, the graphical representation. However, in order to define how to perform algorithms on that, the notation in the mathematical form is more exact. So we will keep both of them in mind and try to do our computations in a graphical way here in the lecture, but still we should not forget how the mathematical notation looks like, because when we specify how the algorithm behind that works, we will resort to the mathematical way of visualizing that, of denoting that. Okay, so well, that's maybe for you at home. We should probably start to illustrate what I want to say with a more elaborate example, where there's more than just one plain attribute equation in here. So let's have a look at the whole system that we have set up for generating finite automata from regular expressions. And for that, we had a whole set of attributes that were interesting for us. Namely, there was this empty first and next. So let's have a look at them and how they cooperate with each other. So just to summarize you, how these attribute equalities looked like. I've mentioned them here once again in the new way of denoting them. So, for example, for the S goes to E, which is just our start production, we had that the empty attribute was synthetic, so the attribute for the root of the subtree, which is empty zero, was depending on empty one. Same as first. First was also something that was synthetic. Just next one was rooted here, so it's not depending on anything, but it's just given as empty here for this case. Then for the leaves, we had also certain specifications, and these were also very local computations. The empty attribute for the root was just whether this particular special attribute called X was actually empty or not. And the first set for E as an attribute was for us actually the value of the attribute X itself in case that X was not not the empty string. And in terms of the dependency tree of these two attribute equations, we would obtain the ones over here. This is the dependency tree for S goes to E. And yeah, here we have these two synthetic attributes, first and empty. So here the edges go from the child to the parent. And next was something where there was no dependency from whatsoever, so we could keep it just without any dependencies in there. So everything that needs to go into the graph representation as set was just two tuples, both of them, well, just corresponding to the edges that I've marked over there. So even more simple is the dependency graph for the edge with just the character in there. And well, for there was just nothing that had any dependencies. Everything could be just determined by local computations. So the dependency set is, in this case, just empty. More interesting is to look at the classical operators that we have in there. For example, the alternation between two sub-expressions. So for there we actually had four kinds of attribute equalities. There was the empty computation, which would just merge the values from both children in order to get the parent ones. Same goes for the first computation. So we see that reflected in the edges going from children to parent, and same is here. So far, so good. Then there's the next computation. For the next computation, we have dependencies the other way around. Next was something that was top down, So we find the new evaluation for next of the left child, but being dependent on the next value of the parent, and same for the other child. So we have to represent all of these in our set representation, and we have the empty computation over here, where we have the dependencies always with the parent's node in the target component. Same is for the first computation. Also, the parent's node is in the target position. And here, for the next computation, we have the dependency that way that the next of the parent is the one that the children's attributes are dependent on. So, yeah. And likewise for the concatenation, for example, we not only have interactions between just the children and the parent, but also between different attributes for once, and also between the particular children with each other. So the easy ones are the empty computation, because that's just remaining clearly between empty of the parent and empty of both children. So these are reflected in here. And then the other easy one is the one for next, where next of the second child is just depending on next of the parent, and that's it with the easy ones. Now there's also more intriguing ones, where we have interaction between first of all different attribute types. So for the computation of first zero, which is this one over here, we not only have input from first one, which is first one is over here, that is the easy one, but instead we also have dependency on the empty attribute of the first child. So that is that particular edge here with this child, as well as first of the second child, so this one over here. So for that we need to add three edges in the whole system, which we can also see in there. So there must be an empty end. Maybe I missed one. I think there should have been an empty one goes to first of zero. So yeah, should have been there. So we can't see them anyway. So anyway, then there's the first one going to first zero. This one is present, and then there's also first of two going to first of zero. So this one is present. Good. And then there's also the evaluation of the attribute equality for next of the first child, and for that we have now interoperation between two children. So next one is determined by looking at first two, which is this particular edge over here, and then there's also a dependency on empty two. So it's this one and this one, which is the second edge over here. And finally, there's also a reference to the value next of the parent, which is this one. And plus, we should find three times next in there. So next one is over here with the empty dependency. There is the next one dependency on next zero, and the first two, like this one. So, in fact, we're with these sets D of certain production, we gather a whole lot of sets of tuples of attributes. Then there's still a few others missing. Yeah, I think you get the point right now. It's just transferring these equalities into graphs or these sets of tuples. So I think you can know about that already. So these are kind of the local dependencies that you can use to compute a strategy for an evaluation that computes you all the attributes. Well, at least if there's no problem with that. So the general question is there actually always a kind of static evaluation strategy that you can, in general, apply for a certain attribute system? So that would be the first question to ask yourself before starting to try to compute such a strategy. And as it turns out, well, there are, of course, ways to specify your attribute grammars such that you just can't give one static evaluation strategy that will do the job for you. In fact, if there are cycles in the dependency graph, you can actually you can not actually find such a static evaluation strategy for that particular attribute equation set. So there's the first criterion, what we have to that we have to find out about for a certain attribute system before we even can think about computing a strategy for evaluation of our attributes. So for that, what can we do? Well, there is a paper from 1975 already which tells us that it's at least exponential to compute for the dependencies whether they are actually cyclic. So yeah, that's something that we might not want to do. Well, that might be too expensive for us. So what you can do to navigate around that is you can either don't bother and just let the user specify a certain strategy hard-coded and let it, yeah? In a graph, not, but you have these the interconnections between those. This is partially graphs, and you have graphs for which can connect to your subgraph in several ways because you can replace the non-terminal that corresponds to this sub-branch of your subtree, and you can replace it with several other subtrees. So it's not just a plain graph, but it's a whole it's a generator system for all graphs. So it's not just proving acyclicity for just one graph, but proving acyclicity for all the graphs that are spawned with that system. And that is where the exponential blow up comes from.
Okay, but for me it looked
Yeah, but you have to keep in mind that you can with one of these subgraphs, you only have one production, and you can combine these graphs according to the identity of the right hand side symbol and the other, and there you get several possibilities for each of the branches how to connect them to each other.
So this originates that you can have different productions for the same non-terminal.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and with that you can create just exponential number of possibilities.
Just to rephrase that to make sure I got it, is the problem that I get a different graph for each regular expression?
You get. So in practice, each regular expression actually yields its own graph. So you would have to argue about all possible regular expressions. Thus, you have to prove acyclicity for everything that you can generate with just regular expressions grammar, and that yields a whole set of parse trees and syntax trees. Yeah, and would have to prove in a finite way that there's no cycles in any of them. So yeah, that's where it comes from. Yeah. Anyway, it's doable, but as you can have an exponential blow up in there, you will take exponential time for checking that. So you can either just give up and let the user specify the strategy and have trust in the user that the strategy will actually terminate and be done with that. You can also try to verify that the strategy is actually compliant and then just bail out and say, well, what you gave me is crap. Then you can try to alter your strategy dynamically, but I have not found too much about that. The other strategy is a little bit similar to what we have had for parser generation. You can try to form subclasses for which you can do the check for acyclicity more easy than with exponential time. Or, well, just have a kind of a semi-decision algorithm that tells you that, that if it couldn't find any cycle in there, for example, then you're guaranteed that there's no cycle in. But if it says, well, there's possibly a cycle, there might be grammars for which there actually would not be cycles, but would still be flagged as potentially dangerous. So that would be this semi-decision procedure. And what I found for you there is this subclass of strongly acyclic attribute dependencies, and that is exactly this this idea of having a semi-decision procedure. And if it certifies you that there's just no cycle in the dependencies at all possible, then you're safe. And if it flags this set of attribute equalities as cyclic, then well, there might be cycles in practice, but there are also it's possible that it's cycle free, and you just can't certify that. Okay. So the idea for doing something like that is that you would try to not to capture the dependencies that are yielded by the local dependencies of the attribute equalities in a precise manner, but you would over-approximate what would happen when you plug these dependencies together and live with what impreciseness you give you get by just simply combining that. And what you would do is you would, for each of the non-determinals, which means for each of the categories of subtrees, you would just keep a list of all the possible attributes, and you would try to keep graphs on the this list of attributes that would represent all the dependencies that can happen if you plug all the these other subtrees into the right hand side symbols of this production and join them together. So for that you would set up a certain data structure, which is just a set of tuples, as we have had for the local dependencies already. So we have set of tuples, and each tuple represents an edge between attributes of that thing. So we would call these kinds of sets, or we would denote them with R of X, for R for relations, and X for because they depend on that particular non-terminal. And now, before we delve into the details of how to set up a formal system for that, I would try to sketch you what we actually want to do. So first of all, we would like to set up the effect that each of the production possibilities that you have for such a non-terminal has on the relations of X, which means what does it create when as in terms of dependencies if you plug the dependencies that you have computed for its right hand side symbols into this in context of this production together with these this non-terminal. And you would if you have connected them together, you would kind of summarize all the effects that are created by connecting everything together and remap it onto the original set of attributes that you keep for each of these non-terminals. And yeah, you would consider that as being an accumulated evaluation of the relations or the dependency relations of the right-hand sides of a non-terminal, and continue to do so until the whole system reaches a stable state. So you would continue feeding dependency informations into these symbols as long as they at some point as long as, until they finally stabilize in their form, and then you're done with everything. So that's this iterate until stable. In particular, what do you have to do for that? You it looks a little bit scary in the beginning, but it's just kind of technical tools that you need to specify what you're actually doing. So first of all, keep in mind that we are working on sets of edges. So these edges consist in always tuples with the source in first, well, for you, in the first component, and the target in the second component. And they have lost any information about parents or children or productions where they actually came from. In order to deal with them, we redecorate these tuples. So we manipulate just the names of them in order to be able to talk about tuples that originate from one left right hand side, another right hand side, and another right hand side. So we need some way to differentiate between each other in order to do the right connections between each other. So for that, we introduce this operator with this brackets. It has three parameters. First of all, there's a basic set, which is just a set of tuples that came somehow from non-terminal, and it's just plain attribute names. And in order to keep them differentiated, we introduce a means of giving it a name from which to which production they are related, and at which position of the right-hand side they actually came from. So that's what goes into the function. And what this function actually does is it takes these tuples, which are just edges that are so far accumulated for this particular non-terminal, and annotates them with context, in the sense that it introduces the positions of this particular non-terminal in the right-hand side of the production P. So it's just redecorating everything. It's still the old relations, but we need to somehow give them an own naming subspace to differentiate between several of these relations. So it's just renaming everything. So the next thing that we need is projection. In the end, when we have merged all the dependency relations of a production's right-hand side symbols together, we somehow want to summarize all the dependencies that we have found in there. For that, we need to get rid of all these additional decorations that we have put into the system with this decoration operator, and just keep relations between plain attribute names. That's something that we can achieve with the projection operator, which is this pi zero, zero because it projects everything on just the attributes that are referring to the parent. So what that does is it evaluates its parameters for edges that just go between nodes, attributes of the parent node, and keeps them without it their context, because, well, we are just talking about the zero anymore, and also in the end we will use that just for one non-terminal, so we can also get rid of the particular name of the production. So what you should take away from that is with L, no, not with L, but with this bracket operator in red, we enrich all these tuples with additional information telling us about positions, and afterwards we take this information away with pi once again. We need that because in the next thing, what we introduce is this effect that production has on the relations that we have accumulated for the root node and the attributes of all the right-hand side nodes. So what we introduce here is kind of an abstract interpretation of a specific production, and this is an effect that is computed on all the on, well, a lot of parameters here, which we will in the end associate with the right hand sides of said production. And what will happen in there is we will take each of these parameters and annotate the set of edges that we find for each of this parameter with its position. Remember the thing that the redecoration does for us. It adds the position information to each of these attributes, so that we know that if there is, for example, an empty attribute mentioned, that it came from the set that was the first parameter, which is associated with the first symbol of the right-hand side of production P. Same is for K. We just give give all the edges that we find in this third in this kth parameter. We give it the index k to mark all the relations that we get from there with k in order to differentiate from all the others. So we take all the relations from the children and annotate them so that we can differentiate between them, and then we add one other component to the system, which is this DP. Remember, that was the local dependencies. That was these subgraphs that you have seen me showing you on the last few slides for the empty next and first. So these are the local interconnections between all the attributes of the right-hand side attributes and the roots attributes. So we mix them into this whole system. The names from DP now are able to match with the names from the sets that have been decorated with our redecorate operator, so that we have now graphs that have edges from the local from local dependencies as well as the accumulated dependencies of all the children, and they build a common graph. With that, now we do something that might be lost when I don't highlight it. We perform the transitive closure, which means that we that with the edges that we have so far, we perform transitive closure in the sense that we connect this graph completely. At least if we have a path from one node to another. So we introduce all the edges that are in between. And we do that because what we actually want to get is that if a parent's attribute is somehow connected to another attribute of the same parent throughout connections that could be bridged through the local dependencies and the dependencies of all the other nodes that we have computed so far, then we also want to have an edge between these parents' attributes. And that's why we perform this this transitive closure. That will come over here, so right now we can't say it's still variables over here, but later on we will apply this function on other accumulation sets of edges. So all you need to know right now is that it's sets of edges between attributes. We still don't know where they come from, but we'll get them from other from these right-hand side sets for the non-terminals. But right now it's just sets, and we use them to refine, or tuples, sets of tuples, and we will use them to refine the edges between the attributes of the root node. So for that we connect them with each other together with the local dependencies, do the transitive closure such that if there is a path from one parent's attribute to another, we can have a direct edge, and then we remove everything connected to the children once again from the whole system by performing the projection. So first of all, we couple everything together with the local dependencies and the accumulated edges from right-hand sides. We perform transitive closure by performing these by adding the edges, especially for the root attributes, and then remove everything else which does not cover the roots attributes. And that is what the effect of one rule in the attribute grammar has on the dependencies between the attributes of a certain root symbol. And all in all, what we use that for is this particular system, where we connect the accumulating dependency sets from different symbols to each other in a certain way. We, for symbol X, we say that its dependency over approximation is computed by the union of all the effects of the several alternatives that I have for expansion or reduction of said symbol. So it's the unification or the union of all the effects of the productions that I have, and these productions need to have, of course, this large X on its left hand side. And now we fill in the gaps that we had with the L's. You were asking where the L's actually come from. The L's come from here. These are the things that are put into the effect of the of this production, and they are actually corresponding to the non-terminals of the right-hand side of said production. So what we do is we take their accumulated over-approximation of relations, see how they can be connected to with each other, and mangled with the local dependencies, and see what the whole thing gets us, and store that as the dependencies for our left-hand side symbol X. And since you can imagine, if you do something like this, you will create a new value each time that you evaluate such an expression. You will obtain a new value for Rx, and there might be other expressions or relations between where this Rx is now a right-hand side symbol. So you have to put this new value into these expressions, reevaluate that expression, get a new left-hand side expression. This triggers other things to get invalid, and you have to recompute, and so on. And that is this the idea that you have to have in mind in order to compute your dependencies. You start with a very basic characterization of your dependencies. First of all, you just emanate from the idea that there's just no dependencies happening, like this, and start with the empty set, and then you trigger all evaluations at least once in order to see what changes when you start with just your minimal assumption, and this will lead to a lot of changes because there's these local dependencies in there. And as soon as there are dependencies, there's communication with each other. There might be dependencies added to your accumulated values. These will at one point end up in new values which are different from the empty set in here. And this will trigger this whole cascade of recomputations. So that is the idea. And in the end, at some point, you will reach a point where it's just where there's just no change in the system anymore, and there's of course always this the situation that you might have computed that everything is dependent on everything, and that is kind of the natural natural condition for the whole system to stabilize, because when there's everything interconnected, you will not get any changes anymore, because all there is to change is all these systems will only ever grow because there's just always union happening in there. So it's a monotonous system. So with this system of inequalities Rx that we have now established, this characterizes our class of strongly acyclic dependencies. And the system is composed of monotonic functions, which is this abstract interpretation of the production rules. So there is a unique least solution of that system, which we can compute via fixed point iteration. And by having a look at this least solution, we can evaluate these expressions for all the productions of our attribute grammar, and if all of them are acyclic, then also our grammar is strongly acyclic. So the idea would be to compute the least solution R star of the Rx by a fixed point computation starting with the smallest value that makes sense for us, and for us, that's just the set of empty relations. There's just no relation in there. So maybe an example to illustrate what's actually happening in there. I start in with the grammar that we find over here. So it's a very easy grammar. It just has two productions, S goes to L and L goes to A, and also L goes to B. Then there's also a set of attribute equalities, but I don't actually need to know about how they look like. All that we are interested in here is just the dependencies between each other, so I give you the dependencies of each of these things via graph. So these are the graphs for the different productions. There's a production S goes to L. It has the attributes H, I, J, and K. And yeah, they look like this. There's these are kind of semi-synthetic attributes, also giving data over to its neighbor and the other way around. Then there's the dependency graph for L goes to A and the dependency graph for L goes to B. So these are the things that we're emanating from. So let's try to compute our over approximation of dependencies between all the possible attributes. In order to do so, we have to interpret the production L goes to A on everything that L is depending on. Well, L is depending on A. I have not given you the or at least not mentioned what we do for terminal symbols, I think, but yeah, terminal symbols, these are just these are no non-terminals. There's no production associated with that. There's no computation happening, so there's no dependency added with just the terminal symbols. So, yeah. Also, there should be probably an empty set here, except for empty set here, and so. All we do here is now look at the right hand side. There's terminals, so terminals don't contribute any dependencies. Then we should we cannot connect anything, so we only have to look at the local dependencies. The transitive closure of the local dependencies is, well, in this case, not giving much. We have only one dependency anyway over here and one dependency over here. So there's nothing so far. We can already check for cycles. That's something we can do that early on during the computation already to kind of have a fast exit as soon as we hit a cyclic over approximation during other computation already, we can drop out early and just say we have found a circle. So yeah, we can ignore that for now. So we have to build the transitive closure. That's in our case, it's pretty easy. It's already there. And then we apply the projection. So we take away everything that's related to the children and keep what remains as the accumulated dependencies of the non-terminals L for now. Well, then, yeah, that's probably all. Is it all? I think for R we would also have to add them with each other, because there's this the union of the two effects here. I think I didn't represent them appropriately in the graphic way. So in principle, I would have to merge them right now into one graphic. So I would have to do away with one of them and add this arrow to the other one. So in the end, I would end up with KJ and IH as the dependencies for L. Then I would continue with the relations, dependency relations for S. And here, what I would do is, well, this is this redecorating step that just consists in connecting the non-terminals over the right hand side with their according so far computed accumulations. So for this L, yeah, there's once again, I think the graphic is kind of copy and pasted. So this thing is at that point not the accurate accumulation of all the things. I should just have one. No. I should just have one of these, and I would have to add them to the local graph, which would then look like this. Now I would have the the connected graph like this, and yeah, I should compute the transitive closure of all the relations. And in our case, well, I haven't done that directly in this thing, I think. But if you look back at that, there's just no path from H to J and J to H in that direction. You would just have to draw a lot of arrows to catch that there's a path over there, there's a path over there, and I think there's also a path over there, and same goes for the other thing. But there's just looking at H and J, they only have incoming edges, so there's no effect on the abstraction of the S itself. You're a little bit occupied with computing yourself.
I'm busy parsing this expression, and I wonder, P, I think it's the production, right?
Yeah.
Lowercase p.
Yeah. Yeah, there's K1, so it's a K attribute of the first child and J attribute of the first child. So it's just the redecorated version of what we had. Is it? Yeah, of that one. So, oh, all the time. This one you redecorated with its position as children, and that's just the one. And yeah, I think at that
moment, I don't really see why I have the P over here, so I might remove that in future. But for now, I'll take it as given.
So afterwards, I have to project everything on just the attributes of the parent in order to get the over-approximated version of the relation over here. And there's no relation for that. So anyway, with that, we have computed all the over-approximations of the dependency sets. And the thing is now, in order to realize whether we have a strongly acyclic grammar or not, we now have to look at each of these right-hand sides and see for ourselves whether there are cycles in there. That was our condition for strongly acyclic grammars, and turns out that with the completed stable over-approximations of our dependencies, if we have a look at the production for S, we see that there's actually a cycle in there. So with that, we would bail out and say, well, we have found a cycle in there. Our grammar, our attribute grammar is not strongly acyclic. So that is the complete algorithm, how you would do it in a more intuitive way. The formally correct one is the one that you've seen a few steps before. I might also want to illustrate you with that slide, that what we have computed here with the strongly acyclic property, that is something that's too strong for a precise argument on acyclicity of our attribute grammar, especially if you look at, well, in our case, we only have two possible parse trees here. So it's pretty easy to actually iterate through all the possible parse trees and check whether there are actually cycles in there. And as you see, I have done so. So there's two parse trees. There's a parse tree for B and the parse tree for A. And if you take this into account, you see that actually for the parse tree for B, there is... Can you spot the circuit, the cycle? No, there's none. And same goes for A. So if you are actually able to differentiate between all of them, you might end up finding out that that's exactly the an example for this semi-decision character of our algorithm here. We have hit exactly one example where we can see that strongly acyclic is not the same as acyclic as a property. So in our case, we failed to prove that the attribute grammar is actually acyclic. But at least we didn't do an error in the sense that we attributed this thing would be acyclic and turned out that it actually had a cycle. So strong acyclicity is for that part somehow useful. Okay, so I think that is a good point to finish today and start with the next larger topic next time. So I thank you for your attention. If there's any questions, you can still ask me. Apart from that, wish you a nice week.